I was going to go like this. I'm Roger Brown, I'm an alcoholic. And it's always an honor to be asked to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I especially feel really comfortable in this room. You know, there's a lot of sobriety that's coming out of this, came out of this room over the years. I've heard about this 1600 club for a long time. And it's nice to be asked to speak here again. So where do I begin? First off, hey, I don't get to dress up like this too often, man. I don't know if I want to hide behind that podium all the time, you know. Because if you come from where I come from, you know, I never in a million years would think that I would be wearing anything like this, let alone feel almost comfortable. Still not quite comfortable, but one of the things I kind of got used to is and what I've learned from this way of life, is to show respect for what I've learned, and that's to show respect for myself first and foremost. Because if you guys are anything like me, I never felt good about who I was. I never felt comfortable. From my earliest memory, I didn't feel good and comfortable and safe. I didn't know what those things were. And I thought that was normal. It was for me for many, many years. There for a long time, I had convinced myself that I was just like Leave It to Beaver. Some of you guys remember. Some of you guys probably don't, but that's what my life was like. That's what my family was like. You know, I know that every afternoon, whether I ditched school or not, when I stuck myself in front of that TV, it was okay for 30 minutes. You know, and I thought it was okay. Probably a lot like a lot of people I listened to. I started drinking. I had my first blackout when I was 12 years old. So I started drinking before then, but I really dug into it deep. You know, right off the bat when I was 12. I had stole my first bottle of Seagram's B.O. from somewhere. And I drank about half that bottle. You know, it was a big bottle too. Of course, I was a little guy, so I don't know how much was actually in it. And it made me deathly sick. And there for a long time afterwards, every time I saw one of those labels and saw one of those bottles and smelled that particular liquor, I got sick to my stomach. But I still drank it. You know, I because of the way it made me feel. It made everything okay. It made everything okay. It probably had a little bit to do with my heritage. I'm Scottish-Irish, you know, and that's just what we do. We do it when we don't feel good, and we do it when we feel good. You know, we do it when we're angry, and we do it when we're happy. It's just the way of life, and that's what I grew up around, so that was normal for me. My dad was a full-blood Scot, and one of the things he had taught me is that men don't cry. Men don't cry, you know, and I'll never forget. You know, I remember, gosh, I had to have been 5 or 6 years old when I was crying about something don't know what, and I wanted a little bit of understanding from him, and excuse my French, but you know, he said, "What the fuck's the matter with you? Are you a little girl?" You know, and so right away, you know, the one person in this life that I looked up to and admired, man, he said I was broken. He said there was something wrong with me, and I never went back again. I never went back to him for any nurturing, because I never felt I would ever measure up. That was one of the first things that happened to me, and that I can remember that made me feel less than, for sure. I felt embarrassed about who I was, and the man that brought me into this world, you know, said I was broken, said I wasn't any good. And I believed it. So I didn't feel good about it. But whenever I found that little man in the can, all that went away. You know, I thought I had ulcers from a very early point in my life. My first drug of choice, as some of you people in this room know, is... Now, that was a little while afterward. Tried that. Pepto-Bismol, my first drug of choice. Yeah. Think about it. You know, every time I went to my mom and I had this stomach ache, you know, what'd she give me? Okay, I know how to fix that. She'd open up this little bottle and pour it in there and give me a spoon. Man, okay, it fixed it. You know, and every time I didn't feel good, every time my stomach hurt a little bit, I went back to that trough, you know, went back to that feel good. And I must have went too often, but pretty soon she said, "Here's your own goddamn bottle, and here's that spoon." And then, I'll never forget, "Oh no, wait a minute. You can't have that spoon. You might stick it in a light socket." You know? Never forget it. She said, "Just take the cap off, pour a little bit in that cap, and go like that." You know, whenever you don't feel good. And it never was the same after that. It never worked as good after that. But that never didn't stop me from cracking that cap open. And why should I fill the cap? I'll just drink about half of it. And it worked again for a little while. So, you know, moving on forward, there's always empty cans and bottles of beer around the place. You know, my dad was a hard worker. You know, when he came home, you know, he drank. My mom drank, and my grandmother upstairs would pay me and my brother a quarter if we'd carry her medicine upstairs for her once a week. And it was a case of, I'll never forget, anybody remember Malvas? Some kind of malt liquor, but that was her medicine. You know, we tried some of that medicine a few times. So I was introduced to that way of life at a really early age, and that's all I knew. And I also knew that I never felt good about who I was. I never fit in. It was always anybody outside the family. It was always us and them. They weren't to be trusted. So I grew up, today I can tell you, I know I grew up feeling, I was scared. I was scared of everything. And I wasn't safe. You know? And fast forward a little bit for a moment. You know, by the time I was 21 years old, I grew up into the type of individual that was willing to do anything in order to be accepted and approved of by the people I was around. I learned really good how to be a chameleon, how to be anything you needed me to be in order for you to like me. And I guess I was pretty good at it because it worked for a while. But I can tell you today, I know that that's where those ulcers came from. Every time Every time that I did whatever you thought I would do, I needed to do, and it was against anything that I felt of value and that were important to me in my life, that little ulcer would act up again. You know? I feel that little pain in my gut. So I know that was my inner self not appreciating that I wasn't paying attention to me. I wasn't being true to me. And that's one of the main principles, that's one of the main things that this way of life has taught me over the years. And I'm a real low bottom drunk myself. It took me a long time to get it, even though I knew it, because I'm not, you know, I'm not the sharpest tack in the box, but I'm not a dumbass either. I'm just scared to death of anything that's new. I'm scared to death of turning around and looking inside, because it's dark and scary in there. And I had to go alone because I didn't have nothing with me. I didn't have no inner strength, and you wouldn't go with me, because all you wanted to do was get loaded with me. You know, that's it. But that worked okay too. That worked okay too, because that numbed that pain. That numbed that little ulcer for a little while. By the time I was 21 years old, I developed into the type of individual that the state of California felt it was a real, and everybody that was sitting in that courtroom felt it was a pretty damn good idea to put me in a cage for the rest of my life. That's the kind of person I was. And they were right. They were right. I was so out of control, I didn't care about myself. I never learned what it meant to be true to me and to care about me. I never knew those words about love and compassion and dignity and respect for myself. So how could I think in that I would care for you and respect you? You know, I didn't care about my own life. There was many times when I was a little kid that I wish I'd never wake up. I wish I remember crying myself to sleep, thinking, damn, I hope I don't get up in the morning. You know? And that's just who I was. So it wasn't really much of a surprise to me, and I was so numbed out from not pain. But when they sentenced me and a couple other people to life in prison that day, I was so loaded on percolethylene, dry cleaning fluid, which is probably just about as bad as pain. You know? I didn't give a shit. It was okay. I didn't feel nothing. You know? I wasn't worth nothing. It didn't matter. You know, this was back in the late 70s. And I knew I was headed for San Quentin. That's where they sent people like me that were just throwaways. You know, wasn't worth shit. Nobody cared. Bring me back, you know, I don't know what it's like today out there, but back in those days, oh man. Anybody in here ever do any time like that? Anybody ever do a little bit of time? I thought so, man. You got that look. You know? Told me to watch out for guys like you in their hoodies, too, you know. Back in those days, man, it wasn't like the institutions are today. You know, one of the first things I remember seeing when I was walking the big yard. That's what they called it. It was the big yard, because they had the upper yard, the lower yard, and the big yard. Right? Me and a guy were walking, and it was about three quarters of the distance of a football field, so it was a pretty good sized yard back in the time. And there was something laying on the ground in there, and it was people were just stepping around it and stepping over it. Thought it looked like a blanket or something. But it was a body, you know. And it stayed there for like about 5-10 minutes. You know, and there's hundreds of people around. And I'll never forget, that was one of the first things I saw that I said, oh, fuck. Where am I at? I felt like I was in the middle of a James Cagney movie. And I was. You know, I'll never forget that. That was that little ulcer acted up a little bit right then. I'll never forget that. Because that was the first time I started paying attention to it. I told myself, oh, you better be careful around here. But that was the way of life, and that was just one of the small ones. You know, I'm not here to tell war stories. You know, a lot of people will say to me, man, I'm, you know, first off, you know, if I'm wearing a nice little suit like this and I don't have a short sleeve shirt on, they say, wow, you don't even act like a convict. I ask myself, what are they supposed to act like, you know? You know? But I know what they're talking about. They expect bitterness and anger and a sense of entitlement, you know, like I'm being owed something. You know, like... But that's not how I choose to live my life today. This way of life has given me some principles to live by, and has taught me dignity and self-respect. It's taught me how to be responsible and hold myself accountable for my choices in life. Because I never knew that before. I never knew that it wasn't okay and that I was responsible if I got in a car with a bunch of knuckleheads and there was guns in there and we had any intention of going robbing people, that how could I be accountable? I didn't have the gun. I wasn't driving. You know? Why is it my fault? I wasn't making the decisions. You know? No, there was no vote on it. They said, come on, let's go. And I said, okay. You know? And that's just the way it was. But that's how I grew up. I grew up not understanding that it was my choice, not holding myself accountable for my actions and my way of thinking. You know, that was the issue. It wasn't that I was, you know, addicted to drugs and alcohol. It had absolutely nothing to do with it. My problem was my thinking. My problem was my way of not accepting responsibility for being a human being and being part of my community. Just because, you know, another thing, and I tell you, it's hard for me to tell stories, but people try to encourage me to tell little ones, so I will. I was number two, and with four boys in the family. Number one brother, you know, he was a real knucklehead, and he was 2 years older than me. He flunked a grade, so that means he was just 1 year ahead of me in school. And so he was a fuck up, you know. We looked quite a bit alike, and some people thought we were twins. So when the teachers and the counselors and all that would see me coming the next year, they'd say, oh, shit, here comes another brown boy. You know, and they already had attitude with me, you know. And I felt it every time. It was like, oh, shit, we're not happy to see you in this room, you know. Because they expected what my brother had given them, you know. Deep down inside, I wasn't that knucklehead. I loved school. I loved math. I loved all that stuff, you know. I remember in my first biology class, I deliberately sat in the middle of two little cute twins, you know. And they, through that whole semester or whatever it was in high school, man, they did my homework for me, you know. So I was cool with that, you know. I couldn't even tell them apart either, you know. That was fun, man. So I liked school. But whenever it came to me facing the authorities, any kind of, you know, people that were in charge, I was always looked down on, and I always lowered my gaze because I knew that they knew I wasn't any good. And so I always shut up, and I never used my voice, and I never spoke up for myself. I just accepted what they gave me, and it was a lot easier, too. They weren't going to believe me if I said, wait a minute, I'm not like my knucklehead brother, you know? You know, I just said, okay. It was easy for me to accept that role. You know, and I did that repeatedly throughout my life. And the ulcers kept getting worse and hurting worse. And I needed to drink more and to use more and to huff more just to cover up the way I felt about who I was. Just to get by enough to sit in front of that TV and watch Leave It to Beeve, and, you know, and feel good for a short time of my life, you know. I spent 35 years in that cage altogether, you know.
Yeah, huh?
They said, what? You did what? How in the hell did you do that? Well, I know I always get those looks, but I'll tell you, what saved my life was this way of life. 17 years in to that life sentence, I hit my bottom. You know, and my bottom didn't come from any kind of a thought about, oh man, maybe I better change my way of life and give myself respect and dignity and feel good about who Roger Brown is, and maybe the board will let me out of prison someday. No, it wasn't like that. It wasn't like that. You know, for me, I grew up, I would wake up in the middle of the night just sobbing, totally broken, you know, and not have any kind of a conscious thought about where that was coming from. I wasn't sad, didn't have a nightmare. It was just there, and I said, fuck, am I going crazy? You know, really. I mean, you know, where's the dope? I need something to fix this. And you know what? I know some of us already really know, but there's probably more access to drugs inside than there is out here. You know, there just is, because guess where they put the drug dealers? You know, they put them right next door. I don't have to go down to the corner. They're in the cell next door. You know, they're right there. And people look at me like, really? And the cops bring what in? You know, like attracts like, as some of us know. You know, like attracts like. And that's what I love about this room. This is a group of people, you know, men and women that were ordinarily not mixed. So what brings us together? You know, we all have a common bond. We all want to find a different way of making it through. And so we figure out some way or another to sit in this room and on Super Bowl Sunday and listen to some knucklehead like me. You know, so you must be pretty desperate, you know, to find a new way to live. You know, if you're anything like me, you know, you're willing to go into any lengths to stop the pain. Because that's what it's about for me. That's my understanding. I know that for sure. There's a lot of things I know that I don't know. But I know that for sure. That's what connects us today as human beings. I don't know your environment, I don't know your culture, I don't know where you've been, but I know that my pain is your pain. You know, and that's where we connect. And my only job in life is to share a little bit of my pain with you, and it'll come back to me. That's my religion. That's my higher power. That's my feel good. You know, because today I know that I'm not alone anymore. You know, I used to feel alone. I used to feel like nobody understood how bad I felt. You know, that's why I could never look you in the eye, because I never measured up. But I know today that it's all about coping skills, you know, that we develop, you know, to cope and deal with the pain of life. It's just that easy. It's not rocket science, you know. You know, and it's with the understanding that I'm not strong enough by myself, but in a group of like-minded people, I can find the courage to be vulnerable and find another way. That's all I need to do. In my life, I got to keep it really simple. I got to keep it really simple. And getting back to my bottom, I didn't know what I was going to do. But I knew if the drugs and alcohol weren't working no more, what was I going to do? Damn, I'm stuck in this bathroom, and it's a tiny bathroom compared to some of the rooms I've been in out here, you know, and this is where I'm going to exist. Prison, it's not fun, but if I can make it, anybody can make it, because I'm not a tough guy. You know, a lot of people say, I could do it in there, wasn't it scary? Hell yeah, it was scary. Why'd you stay? Well, because they had a gun on me. You know what I mean? The only reason I didn't leave, because they kept the wall, the door locked and a gun ready. You know? Believe me, I'm not a tough guy. You know? And my only saving grace when I hit my bottom and the drugs and the alcohol and the denial were not covering up the pain anymore was I said, okay, I'll just take it to the vet, man, if it gets too goddamn bad. You know, and if anybody knows what that means, where'd my homie go, man? He took off. I was ready to commit suicide. I was ready to stop the pain. It wasn't that I was tired of living, because I could live there. And I lived there a long time, you know. And I wasn't scared to die. It wasn't that big a deal because I wasn't really living yet, you know. But I knew that would end the pain. That's what I knew. I said, damn, I know I can stop that pain. Because it was so intense that it was overwhelming for me. It was just overwhelming. I thought about, you know, because there was a lot of my friends that would OD and, you know, cut their wrists and do other kind of weird things that would kill themselves. A lot of good friends did that. And I thought, damn, that's kind of ugly. Man, that would hurt, man, to cut myself right there. I don't know if I could watch that, but, you know, if I just, you know, slip that rope through the vent up there, because they make really strong vents, you know, make sure you don't climb out of them, you know. And I said, that would work. That would work. Nobody would care. No, nobody would care. And I thought, that was my ace in the hole. After I figured that out and I made that decision, I said, damn, if it gets too bad, I got that. I had already been going into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, feeling forced there by the Board of Prison Terms to join this religious group that wanted me to carry Bibles and sing in the choir and all that crap, you know, and I'll tell you, God never did shit for me, so why should I go do something for him, you know, and that's the way I felt. So I sat in the back of the room, you know, they call it the shoe section in there, that's where all the slippers and the loafers and the sneakers hang out. I felt really good back there, because I could sit up there, and the meeting I went to, I started going, it was a big four fellowship at the California Men's Colony. That's where I spent my last 22 years, was there. And I sat in the back of the room and I could talk shit about the guy here at the podium about how much of a hypocrite he was. And, you know, he's just, you know, he was just up there trying to form his game so that when he got in front of the board, he knew I'd talk. That's it. He was just looking for game. How could he be real? He's a convict, probably a murderer like me, a worthless person that would never go anywhere or make nothing out of himself. And one of the things that he was a friend of mine, because you always buddy up in places like that. You know, the colony wasn't San Quentin for sure, but it wasn't no Disneyland either during that time. And you always had somebody you walked with, especially late at night. And me and the guy were walking back from a meeting one night, and I'm running at the mouth talking shit about whoever it was up at that podium. And this guy looked over at me and he said, "Man, when are you going to get it? You know, this program is about you taking your inventory, not everybody else's." You know, and it hit me like a slap in the face. You know, I've been going to that room for 4 or 5 years probably at that point. I had no idea what an inventory was. But the seriousness on that guy's face, going, "You want to get it, stupid?" I thought, "Damn, I thought this was a friend of mine." You know, and he's calling me stupid. You know? And I don't think I had a response for him, but I thought to myself when I got back to my cell that night, I thought, inventory? What the hell is that? I got to figure that shit out. Maybe that's important. You know? And that was one of the things that started me thinking that maybe, you know, maybe I could, if I sat down, shut up, and maybe listen, I could figure some of this stuff out. You know? I can tell you today that one of the best readings that I think comes out of what we do up here is how it works. You know, that's the program for reading. Any newcomers that don't feel like reading and they got some sponsor that says this goddamn big book, man, you gotta read this thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to read. Or I don't want to read, or I'm not good at reading. I tell you, all you got to do is start with this first paragraph and read it over and over and over until you start to understand it. There's one word in that first paragraph that keeps repeating itself, you know, and that word is honesty, you know, and that's one of the first words that I looked inside and asked myself, did I have the capacity to be honest? Or was I one of those unfortunates that seemed to have been born that way, that I was naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty? And then it goes on a little further, and I'll explain why it was important to me, but there are those two that suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. But many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. And I said, wow. Believe it or not, by that time that I was actually thinking about that paragraph, I was working for a psychiatrist in the mental health section of the California, the colony over there. And so that means I was kind of helping along, supervising, leading, whatever, people that had severe emotional and mental disorders, schizophrenia, depression, bipolar, manic depressive, all that kind of stuff. And you know what? I got along real good with them.
Yeah.
I understood them. We was partners, man. You know? So do I have the capacity to be honest? Oh, wait a minute now. Those are the people that I learned to relate to. So guess what? If I have the capacity to be honest, I have to admit that, yeah, Roger Brown has severe emotional and mental disorders. You know? And the first thing I need to do is become honest about that. That somebody that, and just look at it, I had to look at it really simply. You know, does a sane, stable, emotionally mature person watch somebody get brutally murdered and not care? Stand by and say, what? I didn't do nothing. You know? Is that somebody that's sane? No, I don't think so. I don't think so. You know? So, yeah. If I have to be honest with myself, yeah. Yeah, and that's what that first paragraph talks about. You just looking at you and seeing who you are on a heart level, do you have the capacity to be honest about that? It doesn't matter what I tell you. It matters what I tell me. You know, it matters what I am willing to admit to myself, first and foremost. You know, and the other thing I really like about this, because I got to look at this really simply, you know, of how it works. That word, H-O-W, if I use it as an acronym, it's honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. You know, and I'll tell you, remember, who am I? I'm a Scotsman. Open-minded and Scotsman, they're not in the same category. They don't work. You know? So I had to learn what that word meant. I really didn't have a mental grasp of what being open-minded was. Open-minded was, okay, if you're open-minded, you'll agree with me, and that's it. If not, you're wrong. That's it. You know? And do I have the capacity to be willing to listen or think? And no, I mean, I had to really work through that stuff. You know? And again, I'll go back to the idea that I didn't want to do all this stuff, you know, in order to find honor and dignity and self-respect. Because I was so already so low, the lowest bottom that I think I've ever felt and that anybody could ever feel. I got the deepest bottom, there it is. You know? And I can tell you this, I've sponsored many guys, I've helped them understand this way of life as I see it. And a lot of them would come and tell me, oh my God, man, I have it bad. My car broke down, I can't pay my bills, my wife went out on me, and I said, oh fuck. You're really fucked up. You know? I tell you what, there's a way you can do it different. Because guess what I did? Let me tell you about me. You know? Because I know this for sure. If a guy like me can dig myself out of the hole I was in and learn to live by these so-called principles that they teach and they suggest is this way of life, if I can do it, anybody can. I promise you. You know, that doesn't mean it's easy. They just say it's simple. They just say it's simple. You know, and the easy comes when I can start to listen to people like you and find out how similar we are and not how different we are. Because I was always looking, when I was sitting in that back of the room, I was always looking for the differences. Of why I didn't fit in, why I wasn't a part of you. I wasn't a real drunk because I didn't wake up in the gutter every day. You know, not every day, sometimes I did. I never passed out all the time, it was just some of the time. You know? Which kind of brings to mind the idea that, you know, when I really started getting serious about how I fit in and if I fit in, if I was truly an alcoholic, Because when I first started getting up at the podium, when I was challenged, I would get up there then, Raj. You know, I would get up here and I'd say, yeah, I'm Raj, and I'm here for self-help. You know? And everybody would look at me like, yeah, you dumbass. You know? But I was standing strong. You know, because I wasn't going to be like all you other hypocrites who get up here and just agree that you're an alcoholic, not knowing what it meant. I needed to figure it out, you know. And it took some time for me to look at myself, because it's, again, pretty dark and scary in there, you know. So you guys didn't know it, but I was taking a few of you with me. When I would start to travel inside, I would take people that I saw that had some honesty within themselves and some dignity and self-respect. And I'm a good actor. I know how to make you think I like you, because I'll be just like you, you know? And I would take you inside with me. You would just be with me. And you guys helped me learn to have the capacity to be honest with myself, a little willingness to be vulnerable in that dark, lonely cell all by myself, enough times over and over that I could start to do that for once in my life. You know, and over the years, it just kept getting easier and easier, and I started to take suggestion. You know, these principles that you know, that I was first introduced to, I never knew what the hell they were. I stole my first big book. Remember, I think I told you that. You know? I had no clue that they were free to the people in prison. You know? But more importantly, I didn't want you to know that I was willing, because it was the Bible. It was all about that God dude, man. You know? That God dude that didn't answer the door when I was kicking and screaming and crying in juvenile hall, saying, if you just let me out, I'll never do it again. You know, he never opened that door. So he wasn't looking out for me. And my grandmother, oh, she had convinced me, you're going to burn in hell, you little bastard. You know, and I believed that. And I said, well, shit, you know, I might as well party now because I'm going to hell. You know? I'll worry about that shit later, you know? That's who I was, but this, you know, another important thing that I think I would like to share, because I think about, you know, a few of you guys that introduce yourself as newcomers, because when I was new to this way of life, when people would come in here and they would read those promises, it's one of the first things I heard and listened to. They say, if you were painstaking about this, you know, at this point, about this, what is it called? Yeah. That you will be amazed before you're halfway through. You will experience a new freedom and a new happiness. And I said, fuck, I don't belong here. I'm 17 years into a life sentence. And I'm going to experience freedom and happiness. That no matter how far down along the line that I have gone, I will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. You know, that I will know how my past can help others. You know, and that did not click with me, because you didn't. I was in the wrong room, because a lot of people were really happy. You know, and they were doing good, so evidently they weren't me. They didn't have my experience, you know. And so the very thing that turned me away, that told me that I never fit in, is what I embrace today. You know, because as long as I do my part, as long as I keep, you know, trying to learn what it means to be a giver instead of a taker, learning just the simple thing of what does it mean to be of service. You know, all I got to do is keep that in mind on a daily basis, moment to moment, work on my shitty attitude and my relationships with other people, and just learn to be a little vulnerable and honest, you know, and it gets better. You know, and for me, it wasn't about me ever thinking that the state of California was going to let me out of prison. It wasn't about that. I didn't believe it. That was one of the things that saved my life. I had finally reached the point where I really believed that the board, I had been to probably 15 parole hearings where they, every year, because I was an old lifer, so that means I went to board once a year, and they had told me, no, every time. They told me no. And I kept asking them, what do you want me to do? They said, no. No. And they weren't letting, at that point in time, they weren't letting anybody else out either. So I didn't really take it personal. But how it saved my life was I finally had nobody else to please. I finally had nobody else to con. I had finally had nobody else in my life to impress. So I remember, and I it's kind of cliche to think that I looked in the mirror and saw myself. But because I don't remember how it happened, but it seemed like I did. See myself in the mirror and say, well, why not do what you want to do? Why not live the life you want to live? You know, and that's exactly what I asked myself here, you know, because I knew that I was one of them chicken shit little weak bastards, man, that was just really scared of everything in life, you know. So I remember having to tell myself, well, wake up, you chicken shit little bastard. You know, are you willing to dig inside and see who you want to be in life? And that point in time, and I didn't know what it was, but I reflected back to this program. And they talked about principles of being honest and open and willing. And somehow, if I was going to be able to live by certain principles for me. I tried to fake it for a little while. I would listen to you, and you'd say, oh, I had to develop the principle of respect and honesty and dignity, and I'm better now. And I thought, let me try that. It didn't work for me because I was stealing yours. I couldn't use yours. That's the secret with this way of life, you know? In that first big book I stole, you know, I looked for this big list of principles in there, and guess what? It's not there. You know, I said, well, fuck, what good is this? It ain't giving me no roadmap here, you know? But what I finally figured out is, I gotta do the work. I gotta do my work. You know, I gotta surrender to a different way of life. And that's what saved my life. I started digging in. You know, I started with three things, and these are the three things that keep it easy for me today. You know, I started to understand what patience, tolerance, and understanding was. For not so much others first, but for myself. You know, and since I can give myself a little patience, and I've really learned this, that I can't have patience unless I learn to tolerate and understand. And I can't have understanding unless I have patience and tolerance. They kind of work together. And by me using those simple principles for me, I've been able to develop a little sense of dignity and self-respect. And today I can stand and speak my truth in the moment. Sometimes there's people I run across that don't like to hear it. But today I have a voice, you know, and I know who Roger Brown is today. And Roger Brown is not the kind of human being that's going to stand by and watch another human being get murdered for no reason. I'm not that guy today. And guess what? I don't have those ulcers anymore either. You know, I'm good most of the time today. You know, one of the things that I'll end with this, and I got 8 more minutes left if I want it. But I'll end with this. One of the things, this way of life has really opened some major doors for me, not just the prison doors. You know, it's enabled me to gain a little self-respect and dignity, and God, honor, I think, might be another word, because for the last 10 years I was inside, I was part of a hospice program. And I helped 34 men pass on to a different place. You know, and they taught me the importance of living on a real deep level. You know, if you want to know what's important in life, talk to somebody that's getting ready to leave this world. You know, and all the bullshit goes out the window. You know, and cumulatively, you know, over that 10-year period, you know, they all wanted to know three things. You know, and one of them was I loved. Anybody really loved me? You know, because you can remember all the guys I was with were convicts. You know, and most of them lifers. Did I love well? You know, was I a decent human being at some point in my life? You know, and the third thing was, did my life make a difference? Somehow. And what that did for me is help me understand and admit to myself that if I can be totally honest, that's all I've ever wanted in life. You know, was to love, was to be loved, and to make a difference. That's it. And so, am I going to be strong enough to try and live my life that way now? Or am I going to wait till I'm on my deathbed and ask those questions? You know? Because I had to dig inside and ask those questions of myself. Not cry out from the throes of, you know, being hours away from death and ask that stuff. I have to ask it now. You know? And it's all about this way of life is what this taught me, because I know it's true. All I got to do is be a service to my other fellow human beings and be a decent member of my community, whether it's in that cage or out here. It's just live my life. You know, it's more important to me today who I am than where I am. And in essence, that's just what I told that parole board 5 years ago. And that's why they let me out. Because I told them I didn't give a fuck about you. But today I give a fuck about me, so I love you today. You know, I was able to tell them that in such a way. I didn't tell them I love you, but I showed them that I respect them because I respect me. I understand them because they're human just like me. You know, regardless of what they believe, you know, regardless what, how they want to check that box, whether it was suitable or unsuitable, you know, that I was going to walk my walk in life, you know. And that's all I got to do today. And, you know, I get hugs and stuff from women today, you know. They just come to me. I don't have to go hunt them down in the dark, you know. Life is good, I'm telling you. Thanks for letting me share.